Unit 7, Part 2, Development of 4R Skills. Section A, Listening Comprehension. Task 1. Now listen to a news item and answer question 1. This week we will tell about stress and its effects on human health. Stress is a condition resulting from mental or emotional tension. Studies have shown it can reduce the body's ability to fight disease and lead to serious health problems. Almost 2/3 of American workers say they are struggling or suffering because of stress from the current economic recession. That information comes from a recent opinion study by the Gallup organization. Another study found that almost half of American workers expressed concern about their ability to provide for immediate family needs. Not surprisingly, many workers say they are eating or drinking too much and smoking more as they attempt to deal with money issues. Stress affects everybody, every day. Stress is how your body reacts to physical, chemical, emotional, or environmental influences. Some stress is unavoidable and may even be good for us. Stress can keep our bodies and minds strong. It gives us the push we need to deal with an urgent situation. But too much stress can be harmful. It may make an existing health problem worse, or it can lead to sickness if a person is at risk for the condition. For example, your body reacts to stressful situations by raising your blood pressure and making your heart work harder. This is dangerous if you already have heart disease or high blood pressure. Stress is more likely to be harmful if you feel helpless to deal with the problem or situation that causes the stress.
Now listen to the item again and answer question 2.
This week we will tell about stress and its effects on human health. Stress is a condition resulting from mental or emotional tension. Studies have shown it can reduce the body's ability to fight disease and lead to serious health problems. Almost 2/3 of American workers say they are struggling or suffering because of stress from the current economic recession. That information comes from a recent opinion study by the Gallup organization. Another study found that almost half of American workers expressed concern about their ability to provide for immediate family needs. Not surprisingly, many workers say they are eating or drinking too much and smoking more as they attempt to deal with money issues. Stress affects everybody, every day. Stress is how your body reacts to physical, chemical, emotional, or environmental influences. Some stress is unavoidable and may even be good for us. Stress can keep our bodies and minds strong. It gives us the push we need to deal with an urgent situation. But too much stress can be harmful. It may make an existing health problem worse, or it can lead to sickness if a person is at risk for the condition. For example, your body reacts to stressful situations by raising your blood pressure and making your heart work harder. This is dangerous if you already have heart disease or high blood pressure. Stress is more likely to be harmful if you feel helpless to deal with the problem or situation that causes the stress. Task 2. Now listen to a news item and answer question 3.
Women are on their way to holding more than half of all American jobs. The latest government report shows that their share of non-farm jobs nearly reached 50% in September. Not only have more and more women entered the labor market over the years, but the recession has been harder on men. In October, the unemployment rate for men was almost 11% compared to 8% for women. Industries that traditionally used lots of men have suffered deep cuts. For example, manufacturing and building lost more jobs last month. But healthcare and temporary employment services have had job growth. Both of those industries employ high percentages of women. 30 years ago, women earned 62 cents for every dollar that men earned. Now, for those who usually work full-time, women earn about 80% of what men earn. And women hold 51% of good-paying management and professional jobs.
Now listen to the item again and answer question 4.
Women are on their way to holding more than half of all American jobs. The latest government report shows that their share of non-farm jobs nearly reached 50% in September. Not only have more and more women entered the labor market over the years, but the recession has been harder on men. In October, the unemployment rate for men was almost 11% compared to 8% for women. Industries that traditionally used lots of men have suffered deep cuts. For example, manufacturing and building lost more jobs last month. But healthcare and temporary employment services have had job growth. Both of those industries employ high percentages of women. 30 years ago, women earned 62 cents for every dollar that men earned. Now, for those who usually work full-time, women earn about 80% of what men earn. And women hold 51% of good-paying management and professional jobs. Task 3. Now listen to a news item and answer question 5.
Chronic stress reduces the level of the hormone estrogen in women. This might put some women at greater risk for heart disease or the bone-thinning disease osteoporosis. A recent study found that emotional stress may put some older adults at risk of falls and broken bones. Swedish researchers studied 137 older adults who suffered bone fractures after falling. The patients were questioned at 2 hospitals. The study found that the patient's risk of suffering a fall was higher for up to 1 hour after emotional stress. Sadness increased the risk nearly 6% compared to periods with no such feelings. For anger, there was an increased risk of more than 12%, and stress increased the risk of falling by about 20%.
Now listen to the item again and answer question 6.
Chronic stress reduces the level of the hormone estrogen in women. This might put some women at greater risk for heart disease or the bone-thinning disease osteoporosis. A recent study found that emotional stress may put some older adults at risk of falls and broken bones. Swedish researchers studied 137 older adults who suffered bone fractures after falling. The patients were questioned at 2 hospitals. The study found that the patient's risk of suffering a fall was higher for up to 1 hour after emotional stress. Sadness increased the risk nearly 6% compared to periods with no such feelings. For anger, there was an increased risk of more than 12%, and stress increased the risk of falling by about 20%. Task 4.
Now listen to a long conversation and answer questions 7 to 8.
I have in the studio with me today Olivia Payton, who set up the Pacific Bar and Grill in 1994 when she was 30. They now have a restaurant chain with a £20 million turnover. Olivia, what gave you the drive to achieve so much at such a young age?
Well, my parents taught us the important lesson that you should never be afraid of failure. But really, it was when we moved to England from Australia when I was a teenager. I felt like an outsider because of my accent and interests, so that gave me a strong desire to do better at school than those who'd always lived here.
You didn't study catering at university, though, did you?
No, I'd never thought of that as a career. I studied English literature. My parents tried to persuade me to take up a career in finance. My best exam results at school were in maths. But I wanted to be a writer, regardless of whether I could write. I didn't do very well in my degree, though.
So, what do you think has made you successful as a businesswoman? What is it that makes someone able to progress as an entrepreneur in the business world?
Well, in my case, I think it's more a reflection of our mental capacity than all the books I've read and the skills I learned at university. I mean, I can write a good letter now, but that isn't going to make me successful. But I've got a fundamental understanding of business. I can see very easily in my mind how things are going to go.
Okay, let's move on now to talk about your career. First, you got into the soft drinks business.
Yes, in the late 80s. But my brother and I soon found that importing drinks is a bit of a dull business. So we sold up in 1991 and decided to go traveling for a year. But we wanted to work while traveling. Then, when we were in Australia, we met someone in the drinks industry who had a chain of restaurants there. He took us on. My brother was a waiter, and I was working in the office, doing a lot of the day-to-day running of the restaurant, and in doing that, I learned the basics, such as what to buy, how many chefs to employ, and so on.
And you stayed there until 1994?
Yes, then we came back here and started the Pacific Grill.
You and your brother must be a good team.
Well, Tom and I always discuss things, but he's more creative and comes up with all the ideas while I look after the business side. You can employ other key people, but then if you upset them, they'll probably leave. Now listen to the conversation again and answer questions 9 to 12.
I have in the studio with me today Olivia Payton, who set up the Pacific Bar and Grill in 1994 when she was 30. They now have a restaurant chain with a £20 million turnover. Olivia, what gave you the drive to achieve so much at such a young age?
Well, my parents taught us the important lesson that you should never be afraid of failure. But really, it was when we moved to England from Australia when I was a teenager. I felt like an outsider because of my accent and interests, so that gave me a strong desire to do better at school than those who'd always lived here.
You didn't study catering at university, though, did you?
No, I'd never thought of that as a career. I studied English literature. My parents tried to persuade me to take up a career in finance. My best exam results at school were in maths. But I wanted to be a writer, regardless of whether I could write. I didn't do very well in my degree, though.
So, what do you think has made you successful as a businesswoman? What is it that makes someone able to progress as an entrepreneur in the business world?
Well, in my case, I think it's more a reflection of our mental capacity than all the books I've read and the skills I learned at university. I mean, I can write a good letter now, but that isn't going to make me successful. But I've got a fundamental understanding of business. I can see very easily in my mind how things are going to go.
Okay, let's move on now to talk about your career. First, you got into the soft drinks business.
Yes, in the late 80s. But my brother and I soon found that importing drinks is a bit of a dull business. So we sold up in 1991 and decided to go traveling for a year. But we wanted to work while traveling. Then, when we were in Australia, we met someone in the drinks industry who had a chain of restaurants there. He took us on. My brother was a waiter, and I was working in the office, doing a lot of the day-to-day running of the restaurant, and in doing that, I learned the basics, such as what to buy, how many chefs to employ, and so on.
And you stayed there until 1994?
Yes, then we came back here and started the Pacific Grill.
You and your brother must be a good team.
Well, Tom and I always discuss things, but he's more creative and comes up with all the ideas while I look after the business side. You can employ other key people, but then if you upset them, they'll probably leave.
Task 5.
Now listen to a long conversation and answer questions 13 to 14.
Perhaps I can begin by asking you why you think it's important for business leaders to be involved in higher education.
Well, although most graduates still enter the teaching profession, an increasing number are employed by the business community. So it's very natural that we should want to have a say in higher education, the courses that are being offered, and so on.
And do you think the supermarket chain Robinson's needed to be represented on the government committee?
Well, about 50% of jobs that come onto the market don't require a specific degree, so they are known as non-specialist. This area is made up mostly of the service and retail sectors, with the retail sector alone accounting for 11% of graduate jobs. The high-tech industries, for example, IT and manufacturing, were already represented on the committee, and we thought that the opinions of the non-specialist employer, like Robertson's, should also be taken into account.
What about the findings of the committee? What was important to you there?
Well, firstly, in today's world, the knowledge that a student gains has a short lifespan. It won't necessarily be relevant in 20 years' time. The committee recognized that higher education needs to take into account that employers are looking for important universal skills, in particular those of communication, numeracy, and IT.
So, what role do these skills have?
Well, take numeracy. The sort of people who reach the upper levels of organizations are all highly numerate. They have the ability to work with numbers at a very advanced level. So it's important that people can understand numbers and spot a mistake very, very quickly.
What other findings of the committee were important to you?
Another finding was recognizing the importance of work experience. I think it's true to say that graduates with work experience are much more likely to get a job than those without. We need people with the experience of working with others. This makes a big difference. Oh, and the third important finding was recognizing the importance of applied research. We've got a wonderful record for pure research, but it isn't translated into economic growth. That's where we need to build better links between business and industry and higher education.
And do you think these findings are equally important for small businesses?
Yes, even more so. Small businesses don't have time to train people to the extent that large organizations do. It's particularly important to them that graduates have the skills to go into the workplace and make a contribution right from the start. I think the key skills that we've already talked about, together with work experience, are very helpful in that situation. Now listen to the conversation again and answer questions 15 to 18.
Perhaps I can begin by asking you why you think it's important for business leaders to be involved in higher education.
Well, although most graduates still enter the teaching profession, an increasing number are employed by the business community. So it's very natural that we should want to have a say in higher education, the courses that are being offered, and so on.
And do you think the supermarket chain Robinson's needed to be represented on the government committee?
Well, about 50% of jobs that come onto the market don't require a specific degree, so they are known as non-specialist. This area is made up mostly of the service and retail sectors, with the retail sector alone accounting for 11% of graduate jobs. The high-tech industries, for example, IT and manufacturing, were already represented on the committee, and we thought that the opinions of the non-specialist employer, like Robertson's, should also be taken into account.
What about the findings of the committee? What was important to you there?
Well, firstly, in today's world, the knowledge that a student gains has a short lifespan. It won't necessarily be relevant in 20 years' time. The committee recognized that higher education needs to take into account that employers are looking for important universal skills, in particular those of communication, numeracy, and IT.
So, what role do these skills have?
Well, take numeracy. The sort of people who reach the upper levels of organizations are all highly numerate. They have the ability to work with numbers at a very advanced level. So it's important that people can understand numbers and spot a mistake very, very quickly.
What other findings of the committee were important to you?
Another finding was recognizing the importance of work experience. I think it's true to say that graduates with work experience are much more likely to get a job than those without. We need people with the experience of working with others. This makes a big difference. Oh, and the third important finding was recognizing the importance of applied research. We've got a wonderful record for pure research, but it isn't translated into economic growth. That's where we need to build better links between business and industry and higher education.
And do you think these findings are equally important for small businesses?
Yes, even more so. Small businesses don't have time to train people to the extent that large organizations do. It's particularly important to them that graduates have the skills to go into the workplace and make a contribution right from the start. I think the key skills that we've already talked about, together with work experience, are very helpful in that situation.
Section B, Listening-Based Integrated Tasks.
Welcome to mid-afternoon, Dr. Carter. Now, I imagine you are here in Birmingham to promote your recently published book, The Art of Giving Presentations. Is that right?
Well, not really. In fact, the book isn't really recent at all. It came out at the beginning of last year. I'm actually here this week to give a series of talks outlining some ideas I've had since then.
So, are these ideas the basis for your next book?
Well, it's really too early to talk about that.
I see. Now tell me, how did you become involved in this particular area of communication skills?
Well, many years ago, as a young sales executive, I had to give presentations, but I felt I wasn't doing them very well. My boss never actually criticized me, and my colleagues weren't doing any better than me, but the point was that I didn't feel satisfied with my performance. You see, if I'm doing something, I have to do it well.
So you decided to do something about improving your performance.
That's right. I tried to find some books to help me, but there weren't really any available in those days. So I eventually decided on a totally practical approach. I tried to find out what my problem was by studying the way the best speakers gave presentations, by talking to them, even watching them prepare. Then I compared their performance with mine.
And what was your main problem? Nervousness? I know that's mine.
Well, I had always thought it was nervousness, and it's true that at the time I had no techniques for dealing with that. But I think audiences accept the fact that speakers get nervous, and it really doesn't matter. No, I discovered that my number one problem was preparation. Nobody had ever told me anything about how to prepare, and I didn't really know how to do it properly.
When you realized that, what did you change?
Well, before, I used to go through the whole presentation in an empty room, on my own. The first change in my approach came when I realized it's much more realistic and much more useful to do it in front of two or three colleagues. That way you get some feedback. Otherwise, you have no idea whether or not your presentation is effective or which parts might need further attention.
Is that the method you recommend now?
Well, not quite. What I would advise is to make a video of your practice presentation.
Instead of using colleagues?
No, a recording of your presentation to them. Then it's easier for all of you to go back and see what's wrong and how it can be improved. It's actually much better than recording other people doing real presentations, however good they are.
So that's the presentation. But are there any factors which make the presentation itself difficult, even if you are prepared?
Well, obviously, yes. Some speakers imagine, quite wrongly, that every audience is unfriendly, at least at the beginning, and this affects their performance. And then there may be a few people who worry about their lack of experience of public speaking. But really, what bothers most speakers is things like the overhead projector and the microphone. Are they going to work? And so on.
Are there any techniques that are effective for overcoming feelings of anxiety?
Well, first, I have to say that some people never manage to reduce their anxiety levels. What they can do is learn to relax their face muscles while they speak so that they look relaxed, even though they feel just as anxious as before. In order to really reduce anxiety, some experts recommend concentrating on something that you enjoyed recently. But I find this is hopeless. I just forget what I was about to say. For me, though, what has worked is some simple breathing exercises, breathing in deeply and slowly while making a pause. This definitely slows down the heart rate. That's what I would try, first of all.
Something we can all try. Dr. Carter, thank you very much indeed. Welcome to mid-afternoon, Dr. Carter. Now, I imagine you are here in Birmingham to promote your recently published book, The Art of Giving Presentations. Is that right?
Well, not really. In fact, the book isn't really recent at all. It came out at the beginning of last year. I'm actually here this week to give a series of talks outlining some ideas I've had since then.
So, are these ideas the basis for your next book?
Well, it's really too early to talk about that.
I see. Now tell me, how did you become involved in this particular area of communication skills?
Well, many years ago, as a young sales executive, I had to give presentations, but I felt I wasn't doing them very well. My boss never actually criticized me, and my colleagues weren't doing any better than me, but the point was that I didn't feel satisfied with my performance. You see, if I'm doing something, I have to do it well.
So you decided to do something about improving your performance.
That's right. I tried to find some books to help me, but there weren't really any available in those days. So I eventually decided on a totally practical approach. I tried to find out what my problem was by studying the way the best speakers gave presentations, by talking to them, even watching them prepare. Then I compared their performance with mine.
And what was your main problem? Nervousness? I know that's mine.
Well, I had always thought it was nervousness, and it's true that at the time I had no techniques for dealing with that. But I think audiences accept the fact that speakers get nervous, and it really doesn't matter. No, I discovered that my number one problem was preparation. Nobody had ever told me anything about how to prepare, and I didn't really know how to do it properly.
When you realized that, what did you change?
Well, before, I used to go through the whole presentation in an empty room, on my own. The first change in my approach came when I realized it's much more realistic and much more useful to do it in front of two or three colleagues. That way you get some feedback. Otherwise, you have no idea whether or not your presentation is effective or which parts might need further attention.
Is that the method you recommend now?
Well, not quite. What I would advise is to make a video of your practice presentation.
Instead of using colleagues?
No, a recording of your presentation to them. Then it's easier for all of you to go back and see what's wrong and how it can be improved. It's actually much better than recording other people doing real presentations, however good they are.
So that's the presentation. But are there any factors which make the presentation itself difficult, even if you are prepared?
Well, obviously, yes. Some speakers imagine, quite wrongly, that every audience is unfriendly, at least at the beginning, and this affects their performance. And then there may be a few people who worry about their lack of experience of public speaking. But really, what bothers most speakers is things like the overhead projector and the microphone. Are they going to work? And so on.
Are there any techniques that are effective for overcoming feelings of anxiety?
Well, first, I have to say that some people never manage to reduce their anxiety levels. What they can do is learn to relax their face muscles while they speak so that they look relaxed, even though they feel just as anxious as before. In order to really reduce anxiety, some experts recommend concentrating on something that you enjoyed recently. But I find this is hopeless. I just forget what I was about to say. For me, though, what has worked is some simple breathing exercises, breathing in deeply and slowly while making a pause. This definitely slows down the heart rate. That's what I would try, first of all.
Something we can all try. Dr. Carter, thank you very much indeed.